From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
We are speaking about the right of people to resist occupation. And this is the right, and we are not going to move from this principal position just in order to be in the Knesset. We will lose our own political identity and just be there in the Knesset as a part of the Israeli Zionist consent.
Israel's Knesset votes to revoke immunity from popular Palestinian Member of Parliament Azmi Bashara. He can now be prosecuted for publicly supporting Palestinian resistance. We'll speak with him in Jerusalem. The erosion of democracy, how the political right will benefit from the attacks of September 11th, and from mogul to mayor, one of the richest men in New York, multi-billionaire Michael Bloomberg, spends over $55 million of his own money to become mayor, more money than any mayoral candidate in history. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. Afghan opposition forces said today they're advancing steadily toward the key northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif with the help of round-the-clock U.S. bombing. Both sides said fighting was intense south of Mazar, which the Taliban seized from the opposition Northern Alliance in 1998. The Taliban's Bakhtar news agency said U.S. jets bombed in eastern Kunar province yesterday, killing three civilians and injuring six, flattening an empty school. The White House, meanwhile, put new emphasis on the humanitarian aid it's providing Afghanistan. President Bush said after a meeting with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, quote, "We talked a lot about making sure that our great compassion for the innocents in Afghanistan is fulfilled," adding, "We must feed the people." Humanitarian groups around the world continue to plead with the U.S. and Britain to stop bombing so that aid can be rushed to the estimated 7 million Afghans at risk of starvation in the coming months. Most of the humanitarian groups have condemned the U.S. attacks on Afghanistan. White House senior advisor Karl Rove will meet with top-level Hollywood executives on Sunday to hammer out an entertainment industry agenda for aiding the so-called war on terrorism. At the instigation of the White House, invitations were sent to Motion Picture Association of America President Jack Valenti, Viacom Entertainment CEO Jonathan Dolgan, a Paramount Pictures chair Sherry Lansing, and Rupert Murdoch. The invites subsequently went out to the owners and CEOs of the various studios and networks, most of whom quickly agreed to attend. A key figure in arranging the session was Gerald Parsky, who ran the Bush campaign in California. The press will be barred from the Sunday summit, which will take place at a Beverly Hills hotel. One executive who planned to attend the meeting likened the effort to those that followed Pearl Harbor, but insisted Hollywood can contribute in positive ways without becoming a propaganda organ. In related news, the U.S. House of Representatives yesterday, by a near unanimous vote, approved a measure to establish a radio-free Afghanistan to broadcast news and explain U.S. war aims to Afghans in their local languages. Supporters say the broadcasts, which cannot be aired in the U.S. since they constitute state propaganda, are needed to get the truth to the Afghan people. Some lawmakers have been critical of the Voice of America, which purports to offer straightforward news, for not advocating the U.S. position forcefully enough. Congressmember Joseph Huffel, a Pennsylvania Democrat, said, quote, "We must blanket the people of Afghanistan with the voice of freedom, truth, and democracy as we blanket the Taliban with bombs." Italy has announced it's providing a force of 2,700 troops to join the U.S.-led military operation against Afghanistan. Italian Defense Minister Antonio Martino told Parliament the force would include naval, air, and ground units. Parliament expressed wide approval for the decision, with only the Communist and Green parties dissenting. The announcement came as the German cabinet approved Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder's pledge yesterday to provide a force of nearly 4,000 troops at the request of the U.S. Schroeder called the decision historic and a reversal of the country's post-war stance against military involvement outside the region. Germany Germany's offering the U.S. armored personnel, airborne medical evacuation units, and members of Germany's elite special forces, which could engage in ground operations. The German government decision creates serious dilemma for the Greens, the Chancellor Schroeder's junior coalition partners. A majority in the Green Party have called for a pause in the bombing so that humanitarian aid can be delivered during Ramadan, a view held by an outright majority of the German population. After weeks of frequent, often tumultuous briefings by Taliban officials, Pakistan's government this week formally asked Taliban diplomats to stop holding news conferences at their embassy to denounce U.S. military attacks. The request reportedly followed complaints from U.S. officials about the briefings on the embassy lawn, at which Taliban envoys describe U.S. bombs hitting hospitals and schools, defended Osama bin Laden, and claimed the United States was using chemical and biological weapons to flush him out of his Afghan redoubt. In addition, Pakistani newspapers reported that the government has clamped down on domestic broadcasts by Al Jazeera, the Qatar-based satellite TV network that's regularly broadcast video of alleged bombing damage in Afghanistan and statements by bin Laden. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson says she arrived in Beijing. She'll urge China not to use a war on terrorism to crack down on civil liberties and ethnic minorities, especially in its Muslim Northwest. China's called for international support for its campaign against the Uyghur Muslim separatists in the northwestern region of Xinjiang, whom it says have links to Osama bin Laden. But human rights groups and Western experts on Xinjiang say most Uyghur activists are simply campaigning peacefully for greater political, economic, and religious freedoms. Amnesty International has said China's executed several hundred Uyghurs accused of separatist activities since the mid-1990s and detained, imprisoned, or tortured thousands more. A U.S. House Finance Committee voted yesterday to guarantee government backing for the insurance industry. The legislation commits the government to paying 90% of losses from another major terrorist attack, with insurance companies paying the rest. Democrats objected to some provisions of the bill, saying the House has yet to allocate money for unemployment insurance or insurance costs for the tens of thousands of people who've lost their jobs since September 11th.
Look, look, we all witnessed the sweat rolling down Miss Liberty's head. She knows the sleeping giant, she's no longer sleeping dead. Oh, what a fulfillment of prophecy. Let us teach the children, freedom's never been free. It's okay to cry, go ahead and cry, 'cause Jesus wept, but hope and faith he kept. It's a new day.
World order, a brand new day.
It's a
change
new day.
Of mind for the human race.
It's a new day.
World order, a brand new day.
It's
a change
day.
Of
new
mind for the human race.
The die has been cast, and there's no need to fear. 'Cause people, the answer to your prayers are here. Sister Mary, don't you weep. Tell mother not to moan.
The late, great Curtis Mayfield, The New World Order, here on Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, broadcasting just outside another police checkpoint where the Army and state troopers and police continue to stop vans, trucks, and cars. I'm Amy Goodman. As the FBI struggles to crack anthrax cases, authorities have definitely not ruled out the possibility that they may be the work of a domestic extremist group. Popular perception points to Al-Qaeda or some international organization, but with no definitive leads in the case, law enforcement officials are looking here at home. Many domestic terrorists are said to be obsessed with biological weapons, as evidenced by the hundreds of anthrax hoaxes perpetrated by right-wing groups, most often against women's health clinics. In 1995, members of the Minnesota Patriots Council, an anti-government group, were caught plotting to kill law enforcement officials with ricine, a toxin they manufactured using a kit ordered from a magazine. That same year, Larry Wayne Harris, a member of the Identity Christian Church, who Democracy Now! Spoke with just a few weeks ago, managed to order 3 vials of Yersinia pestis, which causes bubonic plague, from a laboratory in Maryland. Harris was caught and arrested, but 3 years later, police found 8 bags of what he boasted was weapons-grade anthrax in his car. The substance turned out to be anthrax vaccine. Harris's ability to acquire even a non-lethal form of anthrax and the press his actions garnered may have inspired other right-wing groups. Since 1998, the number of anthrax hoaxes sent to abortion clinics spiked sharply. Political Research Associates, a group that monitors and analyzes the political right in the U.S., has long believed that the right will capitalize on events of the time to try to limit rights for many. After September 11th, the president of Political Research Associates, Jean Hardesty, began touring the country to talk about the continued erosion of democracy. She joins us now from Massachusetts. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning, Amy.
So can you tell us what your main message is since September 11th? You put out a major paper just before September 11th on Rights for Some, new report targets erosion of democracy. But what about since the 11th?
Well, I would say before the 11th, what we were trying to communicate to people is that the message that the right puts out, that it is the people's friend and that it is against elites and therefore somehow aligned with the average person, using a lot of the language of democracy to make its case, was completely false. And so this lengthy report lays out all of the different ways that the right is actually anti-democratic despite its claims that it speaks for the average person, and exactly the ways in which it's anti-democratic. But I think that September 11th has shifted the ground in favor of the rights agenda to an alarming degree. And I would say in several different areas, most of which are quite obvious, I think, it certainly has silenced the Democratic opposition, so that something like the USA Patriot Act could go through Congress with barely a whimper of opposition, despite the fact that it violates, by my count, and I'm not a lawyer, 5 different amendments to the Constitution.
Explain that act again.
That's the anti-terrorism bill that we've just seen go through that has the most amazing things that can be done to people. For instance, especially, of course, it targets non-citizens, but it also targets anyone who is demonstrating. For instance, I'll read you a provision. Any protest or assembly can be designated an act of domestic terrorism, and any protester can be treated as a terrorist with extreme penalties. Now, this is the sort of thing that you can only get through in this country if you have declared a war and you've frightened people to death. And I can promise you that there will be abuses under this anti-terrorism bill. But that's not the only thing going on. I think there are a lot of eyes watching how the anti-terrorism bill is implemented and how its provisions disproportionately affect people of color and people to the left of center. The other thing that's going on is the Bush administration's attempt to defund the government, what the right calls starve the beast, through tax cuts that have already depleted the surplus that we had and will finish off the surplus in the next round called the economic stimulus package that's now going through Congress as we speak. Add to that funding the military, and I think that the right under the Bush administration, which really is an administration that unites all the sectors of the right under one umbrella, I think that we'll find that they will have, with enormous speed, accomplished their agenda, which was stated during the Bush campaign, that we are going to Washington to limit government, to trim government down to its barest minimum. And then finally, I think the patriotism and some people would say jingoism that's being aroused by September 11th, in the face of this tragedy, we're seeing a lot of use of slogans and use of fear to encourage in people a respect for authority, which is also a right-wing agenda, that in fact you don't speak out, you unite, you become true Americans and real Americans, and that opens up a whole area of potential scapegoating of anyone who is against the war, who questions U.S. foreign policy, either past or present. And I think that that's another part of silencing liberalism and progressivism in this country.
Let's talk about that, Jean Hardesty, the silencing of dissent right now. How extreme do you think it is?
Well, I think it comes from two sources, and one is very easy to sympathize with. I do myself. You know, you're afraid that if you don't support the government at this point, that somehow you are showing a lack of sympathy and understanding for the tragic events of September 11th, as if they were nothing to you as an American. You're going back to business as usual, protesting what your government is doing. But I think that the other problem is that the American people are so united now behind George Bush that politicians are afraid to speak out. And we saw for those 8 years that Bill Clinton was in office how highly organized the right can be to attack anyone who takes a position that they don't agree with. So I think Barbara Lee and her vote was almost exactly the kind of example that I'm referring to. She has been viciously attacked since she voted against giving Bush unlimited powers to conduct the war. And this doesn't come out of sort of random people expressing their First Amendment rights to protest her vote. It comes from an organized movement that for years has developed a highly toned and refined system of attacking a politician it doesn't agree with.
What about the investigation of the anthrax cases? Of course, the first messages that were being put out, like with the bombing of the Oklahoma City building years ago, is that it's someone of Middle Eastern descent. Mm-hmm. But then even the Bush administration was saying they're looking at home at right-wing groups. What about that?
I think it's not a good idea to talk about something you really can't explain. I think that this could be, it certainly feels homegrown to us at Political Research Associates because we've watched the far right for 20 years now, and it feels as if it has, the targets are right for the far right. But I think that we are very reluctant to say whether this is domestic or not, or international, or some collaboration between domestic and international. I think that the fear that anthrax has aroused has had very much the same effect that the bombing of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon had. That is that it has frightened people into approving of almost anything that the government wants to do to anybody that it has the slightest suspicion of.
There's a large piece in the New York Times of last Sunday that has a chart, about a quarter of a page, of the agencies within the U.S. government that Tom Ridge is coordinating, the new director of Homeland Security. First, I was wondering how just the ring of Homeland Security sounds to you. But then the appointments that President Bush has made to his administration. Many veterans of previous U.S. wars, both overt and covert, and the roles that they have played in the past and will play now.
Well, let's go first to that, because I think there's really a story there. The Bush administration came into office, whether that election was won by Bush or not is a separate question. But when they came into office, they had accomplished that by uniting all the different sectors of the right. And as soon as Bush took office, he started to pay back those debts. So you had John Ashcroft at Justice representing the Christian right, and Colin Powell and Christy Todd Whitman representing the moderate Republicans, and Donald Rumsfeld representing the old secular right wing. I think what's happening now is that all of those, that sort of second layer of leadership, the cabinet, have filled their departments with the ideologues that represent their particular sector. So, for instance, Tommy Thompson at HHS has filled his department with people who support a war on welfare and the trimming back of social services paid for by the government. What will happen now, while people are terribly distracted, probably as much by anthrax as they are by the war in Afghanistan, is that all of those bureaucrats nested in those government departments will now carry out their right-wing agenda, the agenda that they came with. So, for instance, when the welfare reauthorization bill comes up, the reauthorization of TANF, which replaced AFDC, it's coming up in 2002. This is extremely important for low-income people, welfare recipients, or people who will be welfare recipients because they're losing their jobs. I think we'll see inserted into that language about marriage and how marriage should accompany any kind of entry into welfare. Now, that is a right-wing agenda item that will fly completely below the radar of the average person. The same thing is true in the environmental movement. There are tremendous changes being made in regulations and rules governing the environment now, one recently on mining on federal lands, that get buried on the third page of the newspaper, and people don't realize that actually the Bush administration is carrying forth its agenda. It's just carrying it forth quietly and under the radar.
Well, Jean Hardesty, I want to thank you very much for being with us, President of Political Research Associates in Cambridge, Massachusetts. If people want to see your report on the right in this country, where can they go on the web, or where can they call?
www.publiceye.org.
Public Eye, that's
I. The name of our newsletter, our quarterly news publication.
.org.
Right.
Well, thank you for being with us, and people can always go to our website, democracynow.org, to get all the links and latest information on guests and organizations that we talk to. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll look at the mogul-turned-mayor, Michael Bloomberg. He spent more money for the race to be mayor in New York than any person in history. Stay with us.
I mean, what if there's no time to lose? What if there's things we gotta do, things that need to be said? For everything I know, I mean, you don't have to agree with me, but once you get me going, you better just let me go. I mean, we have to be able to criticize what we love, say what we have to say. Oh, if you're not trying to make something better, then as far as I can tell, you are just in the way. I mean, what if no one's watching? What if when we're dead, we are just dead? I mean, what if it's just us down here? What if God is just an idea someone put in your head? I mean, what if no one
one's watching? What if no one's watching? I mean, what if no one's watching? What if no one's watching? There would be a sunset and the camera would pan away. But the sky is just a little sister tagging along behind the buildings, trying to imitate their gray. What if no one's watching? What if no one's watching? What if no one's watching? What if no one's watching?
You are listening to Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. What if no one's watching? Ani DeFranco here on Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, Republican multi-billionaire media mogul Michael Bloomberg parlayed his bankroll and Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's backing to narrowly defeat Democrat Mark Green. He will be New York's 108th mayor. While he was a political novice, he built a multi-billion-dollar Manhattan-based global company. One of the questions raised now is what will he do with his controlling interest in that company? Bloomberg spent more than $55 million of his own fortune to win the right to govern a city facing the worst fiscal crisis since the 1970s. He has run in a city that is Democrat 5-1. But he won. Green faced lingering resentment among Latinos and African Americans, upset by what they considered racially divisive tactics against Bronx Borough President Fernando Ferrer in the Democratic primary runoff. Ferrer and Reverend Al Sharpton refused to speak out for Green this past week, likely costing Green crucial votes in minority neighborhoods that are Democratic strongholds. In fact, one of the first things that Michael Bloomberg did after he won the next morning, Wednesday morning, was have breakfast with Fernando Ferrer. We're joined on the telephone and in our Firehouse studio by several people to talk about this victory. We're going to begin with Les Payne, who is the managing editor of Newsday newspaper. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
Well, that's deputy managing editor.
Deputy managing editor.
Thanks for the promotion.
Anytime. You certainly deserve it. It's then higher than that. But let's start off with who Michael Bloomberg is.
We don't know a lot about him. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, we've written stories about him. I mean, he describes himself as a single straight billionaire Republican. We know him as something of a recovering Democrat, having been a Republican only for about a year now. He joined the party because he figured he would have a better chance to be the mayor that way. He obviously, well, he's from Boston. He, as you said, is a billionaire. He spent $55 million of his own funds. We don't really know what he will do. We don't know quite enough about his style. We do know that he's a businessman. We do know that he's a self-made billionaire. But how he will govern, what his style will be, what his alliances will be, he's not beholden to an awful lot of people. I mean, an interesting thing to discover soon is what will be his relationship with the current mayor, Giuliani. Some people see this as an extension of Mayor Giuliani's influence, if not his power. But it's pretty clear, I think, that given the two egos, I don't think Mayor Giuliani would have an undue influence for too long a time. But who knows?
In fact, in your newspaper, Newsday, it described the meeting that Bloomberg had with the Democratic primary candidate, Fernando Ferrer, as much warmer than when he came over to City Hall yesterday to stand with Mayor Giuliani. And I wanted to ask Randolph Scott McLaughlin about this, professor of law at Pace University and voting rights expert, about what happened in the primary and whether you think Green torpedoed his own election with how he treated the Latino Bronx Borough president who ran against him and might have won the primary.
I think the seeds for the Green loss in the general election were sown in the primary runoff. There was no question about it. Now, Mr. Green wishes to distance himself and did try that from those who used racially divisive tactics, trying to tout Reverend Sharpton as having an undue influence over Mr. Ferrer. I think that essentially jettisoned any hope he had of winning that election. because the one thing anyone should learn in New York City is that without a coalition built across racial lines, across economic class lines, you can't win in New York City. And in a race that was as tight as this race was, had Mr. Green not alienated the black and Hispanic voters, there would have been a greater turnout and certainly more support for him, and that vote would have put him over the top. I think that New York City, a new day has just dawned in New York City politics. Now, I just want to remind the listeners that it wasn't too long ago that blacks and Hispanics did not support the same mayoral candidates, in fact, supported different candidates. And this was the first time in the history of the city that the black and Hispanic voters coalesced behind, and the unions coalesced behind, Mr. Ferrer. And in order to destroy that coalition, racially divisive tactics were used. Phone calls were made to voters, not all voters, certain voters in certain sections of the city. And, you know, you can't take us for granted. If you want our vote, you got to respect that issue. And I think in the next go-round, whoever the candidates are, hopefully the Democratic side will have learned that if you play that game, you're going to lose the election.
I think it's part of a continuum. I think that if you go back a while, I think beginning in 1988, when Jesse Jackson, by capturing New York in his presidential primary drive in the Democratic Party, more or less put together that coalition of black and Latinos, which Dinkins won on. 4 years later, though, I think that Giuliani was able to break that coalition by operating Nympha Segarra, Herman Badillo, and others to break to get enough of the Latino vote over to the Republican Party to break what had been the coalition that got Dinkins elected, which allowed Giuliani to win. And I think if you look at the numbers, much is being made about the disaffection of the Latino vote. And it, anyone who walked the streets of the Bronx and Upper Manhattan, as I and several others did, I mean, it's pretty clear that Green was gone insofar as the Democrats, Latino and African American Democrats, being enthusiastic about his winning. But having said that, when you look at the numbers, what you find is that when Ruth Messenger 4 years ago ran against Giuliani, 43% of the Latinos voted for Giuliani. So it is not this massive disaffection of the Latino votes on the Republican Party. Giuliani had 43% of them 4 years ago, and so there's about 47, only 3 points up. I think the problem is that a lot of them did not come out on the Latino side. And if you look at the African-American side in the finals, 71% of the African-American voted for a state with Mark Green.
Well, that's true. I think the question, I think Les points out correctly, is that the Latino voters were disaffected and voted with their feet.
Right.
And if you in a close race like this, every vote counts. And, Mr. Green ran the campaign. One said that he was already, measuring the drapes for Gracie Mansion before he had won the election. But turn to Mr. Bloomberg. Now, the question going forward is, well, what kind of a mayor is he going to be? And, yeah, he's a rich multimedia mogul. But I think, at least at this juncture, and since he is the mayor, I'm looking for signals. The fact that he sat down with Freddie Ferrer the day after the election says a lot to me. And if he has any ability and any sense at all, he'll realize that this city faces the worst economic crisis it has faced since, as you said, the 70s, maybe even since the Depression, because of the devastation that attack on the World Trade Center has wrought in New York City. And there's going to be a lot of pain in New York City over the next 4 years.
I want to bring in our guest in the studio right now, Rachel Leon, who is Executive Director of Common Cause in New York. Bloomberg LP, it's established in 1981, provides news and information to clients, including financial services firms and media outlets, also has radio, television, and publishing operations. Michael Bloomberg is the largest shareholder, almost three-quarters, has 7,800 employees in 67 countries. Key product, the Bloomberg, a computer terminal providing clients with real-time financial and general news and market data. It's got 162,000 terminals worldwide. wide. Annual sales from terminals, $2.4 billion. Total sales, $2.5 billion. And Michael Bloomberg spent, more than $55 million of his own money. And use that in a saying, casting that, trying to cast it in a positive way, saying it means I'm beholden to no one. What do you think about that, Rachel Leon?
Well, I certainly think this race is the newest vivid illustration of the man with the deepest pockets getting the most speech. I mean, he spent estimated more than $40 million of those dollars on TV ads and other media advertising. So I think what we've seen is 6,500 ads for Bloomberg versus 2,500 ads for Mark Green. So certainly money talked loud and clear in this election. Now, there were other voices, which we've been talking about, and a lot of other things, like September 11th and the Giuliani endorsement. But, I mean, there's no doubt that he was able to buy so much time and that we're going to have to reclaim our airwaves if we want to keep democracy flourishing. So, I mean, it's frustrating because we live in a city with the best working public financing program in the country. And it's a testament to that that Mark Green, I think, was even competitive against Bloomberg because of that public financing system. But if you have these billionaires and it's a voluntary system, they can just walk all over it.
I think when Mark Green gave his concession speech early on Wednesday morning, he said that an aide had turned to him and said, you're being outspent by $45 million. No one has ever won with that kind of discrepancy. And he said, well, maybe we didn't beat the odds here. What about that? I mean, with all of the politics on the ground that we've heard Les Payne and Randy McLaughlin describing, do you think it just came down to the brute force of money, Bloomberg not being around very much, but just absolute avalanche of torrent of ads constantly?
Well, I don't think that Bloomberg won because of money, but I don't think he would have been a serious candidate without it. And then if you couple that with everything else that was happening and the fact that he was able to buy time during the World Series, I mean, we just can't underestimate the power of getting these commercials over and over and over again. So I think it's several factors, but certainly money influenced this race.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. Money had an influence.
Randy Scott McLaughlin.
But remember, the vote was extremely close. You know, I'm looking at the numbers today. It was 47% to 50%, a 3% differential. If Mark Green had gotten 4% more of the voters, there would have been a world of difference. So even with all his money, he didn't get a landslide. Now, where did Mark Green's vote not turn out? Well, the unions didn't support him the way they supported him nominally, but 1199 has one of the strongest get-out-the-vote machines in the city of New York, and they weren't there for him. Why? Because he had alienated Mr. Rivera and the way he handled the Ferrer matter. Mr. Ramirez in the Bronx also has a strong machine, probably one of the last machine politicians left in New York City, and he didn't turn out to vote for him. So, you know, you can spend money, but if you don't get your voters out, and he didn't, and Bloomberg doesn't have a street campaign. He doesn't have shock troops that can bring out voters and drive them to the polls. So he depended on the buck. And when you're running against money, you have to meet that with people. And Green just alienated the people who could deliver the voters to the polls.
Rachel,
that you bring up important points, and I think that's a lot of what happened in this election. But we also can't underestimate the way that campaigns have changed. And they've gone from grassroots door-to-door campaigns to campaigns on television. And so if you look at the United States, which is one of the only countries in the world that doesn't offer free airtime to candidates, we can't say it's not a factor. It's not the deciding factor, but it's a serious factor.
When you talked about public airwaves, explain what you mean and what you want to see. What is Common Cause advocating?
Well, it's supposed to be, allegedly, that the public owns the airwaves. And yet, we take broadcasters on their word that they're going to do public service. And so then we allow them to make billions of dollars off this. In the 2000 elections alone, candidates paid them more than $1 billion to run these ads. So this is a huge profit industry. And now more than ever, we have to look at the system and say, not only, does it offer ads instead of real discourse on the candidates during an election, but it's overshadowing one of the finest public financing systems in the country. I mean, we had an election of contrasts this week. We had small grassroots candidates that raised, dozens of small contributions that were able to make campaigns because of the public financing program. And then you have Bloomberg on the other side who didn't participate in the program and tried to make a mockery of it. So we need to deal with free airtime. We need to get back to the broadcasters, giving something back to the public. for all the profit that they make.
Less pain.
I don't disagree with that. I think it is a separate issue, though. I mean, I think we can obviously discuss them at the same time because they're part of the same process. I happen to think, I mean, if you look at what Perot did some years ago, going directly to the people with his little video cassettes. So I think there is a way that you avoid scrutiny, as Bloomberg did, and going directly to the people. And campaign finance reform certainly is an issue that whose time is past and hopefully will get dealt with. But going back to the other side of the equation, I think that all of that said, and I don't disagree with anything I've heard on the Common Cause side, Bloomberg coming from nowhere. I mean, a year ago, we didn't know who he was. I mean, granted, we don't know enough about him, but we didn't know who he was other than his name on his media outlets. But I think getting back to the issue of Mark Green, I think that despite his coming from obscurity, Bloomberg, to being almost a household word on ads, it was still Mark Green's campaign, toward the end of the day, to lose, and I think he seemed to have worked pretty mightily to lose it. And I think that what he emphasized is one of those things that people don't like to talk about. In fact, this has kind of been put off the burner, is that the reality is that 54% of the city is Latino and African American. And these campaigns and are run with that thing in mind. I think that someone like Sharpton plays an enormous role here, and we could talk about it. I mean, often he plays a double game and sometimes even a triple game. But without getting into the Sharpton factor, I think that
what's the triple game?
Well, the triple game is he talks to everybody. He talks to all sides all the time, and God only knows what deal he has going with all sides all the time. I think that we need to be a bit – I mean, I think the critical question or a critical question about – for instance, if you look at what the Latinos voters did, there's no question but Roberto Ramirez and as was just described early, a lot of the Latino leaders – I mean, if you went – to the Bronx County office. I mean, last week it was closed. Sunday it was closed. Workers were told to vote and to take the day off on election day. These are the get out the vote people, the phone banks. So there's no question but that the Bronx machine closed down for its candidate in a city that is 5-1 Democratic. So Green, because they had turned against Green. But the question, it seemed to me, is was their disaffection with Green a strategy worked out in the cold logic of realpolitik, or was it just kind of an emotional reaction to a perceived slight by Green on the part of Ferrer? And the more you look at it, unfortunately, I think it is that this thing was personal and narrow and not tactical and sustainable and politically logical. And I think that perhaps is a mistake.
I think you're right. I think that the voters weren't voting. The Hispanic voters who gave 47% of their vote to Bloomberg didn't, and 49% to Green. I mean, it's a pretty close number. They didn't look at Mr. Bloomberg as their savior or as someone who's going to trumpet their cause. I think it was an anti-Green vote, and it was an emotional vote, in my opinion, against the tactics of Mr. Green.
And therefore, kind of silly, isn't it?
Well, people vote for all sorts of reasons, Les. And, you know, people, they're emotional voters. I think some voters voted because they were afraid that Mr. Green couldn't lead the city out of the economic crisis that it's in and rather have a businessman do that. People vote for all sorts of reasons. People voted for John F. Kennedy because he looked good.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Les Payne, Deputy Managing Editor of Newsday, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. Rachel Leon, Executive Director of Common Cause New York. Web contact is commoncause.org. And Randy Scott McLaughlin, Professor of Law at Pace University and voting rights expert. When we come back, we're going to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and we'll speak with Azmi Bashara, a member of the Israeli Knesset. He is an Arab member of the Knesset. He has been stripped of immunity, the first time for issues of speech. We'll find out why. Stay with us.
Did you see them praying? Watch the army marching in. As they clubbed old women, did you see the general grin? watch the stones fly and the snipers taking aim. On Shatila's birthday, it's a calculated game, and they're gunning down the children of Jerusalem. Did you hear him screaming? Watch the horror in his face as he hid for cover in a tiny unprotected space. Did you see his father pleading? There is a child here, trying to protect his son, who yelled in horror and in fear that they're gunning down the children of Jerusalem.
David Rovix live in our Firehouse studio will be with us through this hour and the next of our two-hour War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, the Israeli Knesset has voted to revoke the parliamentary immunity of Palestinian MK, that's member of Knesset Azmi Bashara. Bashara is the only parliamentary representative of the National Democratic Assembly, the first Palestinian party in Israel to call for the transformation of Israel into a state for all its citizens. The action comes after Israel's attorney general filed two separate draft indictments against Bashara and will allow Bashara to stand trial. The first indictment charges him with incitement to violence and support for a terrorist organization, that's Hezbollah, as defined by Israel's Prevention of Terror Ordinance. It's for two speeches Bashara gave, one at a rally in an Arab town inside Israel, the other at a memorial ceremony for Syrian President Hafez al-Assad. In both speeches, Bashara addressed the internationally recognized right for an occupied people to resist occupation. The second indictment charges Bashara with violating Israel's emergency regulations by, quote, abetting illegal exit from the country. Bashara organized humanitarian visits to Syria for elderly Palestinian citizens of Israel who've been forcibly separated from their families for over 50 years. Well, this is the first time that the Israeli Knesset has removed a member of parliament's immunity for speech rather than on criminal charges. Azmi Bashara is a well-known Palestinian intellectual and politician, head of the Arab Students Union throughout Israeli universities in the 1970s. He taught philosophy and political science at Birzeit University in Ramallah. In 1999, Azmi Bashara became the first Palestinian to run for Prime Minister of Israel. In this year's election, which pitted Ariel Sharon against former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, he called for a boycott of the elections, and he joins us now from Jerusalem. Azmi Bashara, can you tell us your response to the indictments?
Well, I think the indictment is the beginning, actually, of a longer process which aims at delegitimizing Arab participation in Israeli politics. They want, of course, to introduce stating political ideas as if it is a crime. It's the first time that the immunity of a Knesset member is lifted or revoked because of political statement that he made. So it also reflects, actually, a nationalist, radical, and even chauvinist atmosphere in the parliament and in the Israeli streets. And this atmosphere, this mood, is used by the Israeli establishment to redraw the limits of Israeli democracy so that Arabs will be excluded. Of course, they begin with Azmi Bashara, but it seems that the precedent is dangerous because it may lead to more exclusion of more Arab Knesset members and probably the Arabs in Israel. So it is heading in the direction of an apartheid system, actually.
Can you summarize the indictments against you?
Well, the first indictment has to do with political statements that I did, giving legitimacy or recognizing or acknowledging the right of people under occupation to resist occupation in South Lebanon at the time of Israeli occupation and the West Bank and Gaza as well. Now, this sympathy to resistance of occupation and to the right of people to fight for their self-determination against the violence of occupation, against the daily violence of occupation, was considered by the Israeli establishment here as identification or expressing sympathy to terrorism, which is false, which is not true at all. The second charge has to do with enabling Arab citizens from this country, elderly people usually, to visit the refugee camps in Syria in order to meet brothers and sisters, and literally brothers and sisters, from the same parents who they did not meet for 53 years, since 1948. We're speaking about old people whose first and last chance to meet these brothers and sisters and relatives before they die was granted by this effort that I made by convincing the Syrian government to list these people in. Now, the Israelis consider this a humanist effort that is usually organized in the world by organizations like the Red Cross. They consider it an organized trips to an enemy country, according to the emergency rules. The emergency rules were introduced here by the British colonialism and were meant to prevent offenses against the security of the country and to prevent espionage or something like that. But these trips were organized publicly. The people legally moved from Israel to Jordan and from Jordan to Syria. The media covered that. It was even very exciting in the media for many people to see, very moving, very touching for people to see how all people meet each other after 53 years. And all this turned into a charge in an Israeli court against the political, not against, against a Knesset member who anyway has immunity.
Is it true that an Israeli Arab reporter went with you to Syria and showed it on television?
No, an Arab reporter from the Israeli TV, from the official Israeli TV, accompanied them to the refugee camps, and he made a film about it for the Israeli news, for the Israeli First Channel. So everything was so public and so known, etc. Suddenly it becomes a charge. Of course, according to the, not the spirit of the law, but according to the text, yes, these trips are illegal. But since when? I mean, these laws are meant to prevent brothers from meeting brothers or sisters from meeting sisters. This was not the spirit of law. This was not meant to prevent people like these to meet.
And on the issue of resistance, do you support armed struggle?
Well, I cannot support or not support armed struggle. I cannot even call for armed struggle. I used the parliamentary work in order to be in the parliament and to use political means. But people in Nablus or in Hebron under Israeli occupation, they do not have democratic tools to use. Occupation is violence, and resisting occupation is resisting violence. Now, international conventions recognize this right. And it even the Geneva Convention speaks about by all means. I do not say by all means. I say the right to people to resist occupation. Of course, I draw certain limits. And I draw certain limits not because I want each day to condemn the actions of the Palestinians in order to find admiration by the Israelis. In general, my position is that killing innocent civilians is immoral and also, for political purposes, is wrong. It doesn't bring anything for any just cause. It is immoral, it is unjustifiable, but also irrational too. These are the limits that I draw. But in general, people under occupation, resist occupation, they did that in France. That's where the word resistance comes from, actually. We didn't have it before that. And it was used in Algeria against the French. Of course, the French killed the Algerian resistance terrorism, but they called their own resistance against the German occupation. And it was used in every national liberation movement. Resistance is something recognized, especially in the second half of the 20th century. It became actually international consent. Terrorism is a different story. It has different roots. It has different reasons. it goes in different direction. There's still another differentiation to make concerning international terrorism. This is another third category. We are speaking about the right of people to resist occupation. And this is a right, and we are not going to move from this principal position just in order to be in the Knesset. We will lose our own political identity and just be there in the Knesset as a part of the Israeli Zionist consent.
We're also joined on the telephone from Jerusalem by Dr. Amnon Raz Krakoskin. Can you tell us your response to this unprecedented revocation of parliamentary immunity on the basis of speech?
Well, I think that indeed it tells more about the state of Israel and Israeli society in the present than on Azmi Bshara and his statements, because his statements indeed are moderate and very, very important and interesting, as usual, because Azmi, for a long time, is one of the most significant intellectuals in Israel and challenged many aspects of the Israeli consciousness. And in that sense, I think that the problem of the problem is not only to delegitimize the very political participations of Arab citizens in politics in Israel, but also the political debate itself. Because rather than a political debate on these arguments, which are so important, they condemn them through a campaign of incitement against Azmi, against his party, and against others. And the problem is that, unfortunately, most of the Israeli society participate in this attempt to delegitimation and demonization.
Dr. Amnon Raz Krakoskin, as a Israeli Jew, what do you think of Azmi Bashara's laying out of a democratic state that is not determined by your religion, in this case being Jewish?
Yeah. As an Israeli Jew, I indeed hope for a common state, an equal democratic state of all its citizens, rather than continuing with the definition of a Jewish state that excludes its Arab citizens. And I think that what happened with Azmi Bshara is that he revealed the contradictions of the attempt to define Israel as a Jewish state and directs towards a different definition. And therefore, I think that Azmi Bshara's ideas, Azmi Bshara's statements, are a very important challenge for any Jew in Israel. And I hope that more Jews will agree to discuss it, and to discuss it in the political terms rather than exclude it into the court, because this is not the place. You see, as an Israeli Jew, it's unbelievable to think of people of victims and refugees who condemned and prevent the visits of from its citizens to visit their refugee relatives in Lebanon and in this case in Syria. It's simply unbelievable. And the question is indeed how we should define differently Jewish collectivity in Palestine. And that's why I think Azmi Bshara's challenge is so important. And we have to use this opportunity, I mean, unfortunately, to reveal the nature of Israeli democracy.
Dr. Amnon Raz Krakoskin, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor of Jewish History at Ben-Gurion University, and Dr. Azmi Bshara, member of the Israeli Knesset, who's just been stripped of his parliamentary immunity for speech. That does it for this program. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland's at WBIX.org, where we broadcast live. Also at webactive.com and our website, democracynow.org. Tonight, I'll be at SUNY Stony Brook to hear a speech of Laurie Garrett on bioterrorism at the Stoller Recital Hall. That's at Stony Brook, Long Island, tomorrow, Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. Democracy Now in Exile, broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Did you see the roadblocks letting nobody go past? Why watch the blood flow as time is running fast. See someone's brother taking his last breath.